This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I am Gaius, John Batchelor. Germanicus is here, Michael Vlahos. And we've been discussing Kief, but it's no longer a large enough story given the fragility of the Ukrainian forces, needing 500,000 recruits. When? Needing ammunition. When? Needing a great deal of endurance to survive what is coming, which is a Russian offensive. They'll pick their spots. However, we turn to NATO because over these last days, while DCI Burns has been saying they're going to make, the Russians are going to make large advances, we've been listening to the president of France repeat himself several times that the possibility is that we will need NATO troops in Ukraine. At the same time, Vladimir Putin repeating himself, if there are Ukrainian troops deployed in Ukraine, then, and fill in the blank of escalation. We also have reason to believe at this point that the Europeans have become focused on resupplying their own military, remilitarizing the parts of Europe that are not now remilitarized, and spending a great deal of money to build their industrial base for the long term. All of that suggests that the Europeans are rattling into shape to realize that the loss of Ukraine means that they're going to have to defend themselves until and if NATO finds a way to resolve the conflict. One way to resolve the conflict is active warfare. It won't start with a big bang. It'll start with the deployment. Where and when, I don't know. Germanicus, I can't see the future. If you and I were talking in 1938 right now, we would say, well, the Germans might move, and then we'd somewhere on the map, we'd point to Czechoslovakia. We'd say, what comes after Czechoslovakia? Maybe Austria. Or we'd point to Finland, the Finland War, which breaks out, and we'd think, well, you see, we were right. It was Finland. Neither of us would say Poland. And when they did move into Poland, both the Soviets and the Germans, we would say, well, what's Britain going to do about it? It's none of our business. You see my point. You can't guess where the escalation is going to start. It's always a surprise. It never makes any sense. And yet it will lead to the larger conflict. It doesn't mean that NATO needs to put troops into Ukraine to start the conflict. How do you see NATO's conduct these days? Is it properly inflammatory? Is it rhetorically credible? Is Russia listening?
I think it's important to put broadly, if you can call it this, the NATO collective consciousness into a kind of contextual framework. And what would that contextual framework be exactly? Well, I would suggest that perhaps we should go back a year to the beginning of the second year of this war, the early spring, with these incredibly pent up, unrequited expectations of the greatest counteroffensive, as some called it, that would decimate the Russian hordes and send the orcs flying in a glorious victory. And that expectation was dashed, and it was dashed in a kind of excruciating slow motion train wreck observed by the world, which one could watch every day as the Leopards and Bradleys piled up one on top of the other in Zaporizhia. This led to a really powerful moment of a kind of crisis of faith in NATO. And so what I think began, say, around July or so, was a process that NATO has been going through that I would compare to Kubler-Ross's stages of grief, which, as you know, begin with denial, then goes to anger, then bargaining, then depression, then acceptance at the end. Well, NATO was in denial as to the results of the offensive and thus the ability of Ukraine to win for a long, long time. And then, as it became impossible to continue to rationalize the possibility of the offensive still paying off, you had a surge of anger, which has lasted through the winter, especially as Avdiivka fell, and no one thought it could fall, and fall so quickly. There was a lot of venting in the Western press. And now I think what Macron represents is kind of the voice of a parable in the context of a changing NATO consciousness that is still nonetheless struggling, wrestling with itself as to how it can come to terms with something impossible that cannot be retrieved. And this is the bargaining stage. So in the face of the reality of an irretrievable diagnosis, the eventual defeat of Ukraine by Russia, the negotiation for an extended life is made in exchange for a reformed lifestyle. Well, what is that reformed lifestyle? It is, of course, obviously finding the troops somehow. It is obviously finding the ammo somehow. Neither of those is possible. So what would you bargain for a reformed, to represent a reformed lifestyle that NATO had seen the light and now could save Ukraine? Well, that would be the deployment of troops, which, frankly, Gaius, we've talked about months ago. And when I first broached the idea of NATO troops going into Ukraine, people laughed. They scoffed at this. But now you have the president of France suggesting that some sort of corps d'armée.
All right, wait. You just triggered an imagination here, okay? If the front line is overrun and Russia has armor columns heading for Kyiv, you think they're going to sit by and watch at the border?
This is exactly the problem. NATO understands the diagnosis, and they understand the consequences. They've been in denial, and they've been angry, but now they think there's still some possibility. This is the danger. So if we turn to this stages of grief, there is the significant danger that no matter what their rational mind tells them, the NATO leaders feel that they have to at least demonstrate that they can pull out something, that they are not hollow men.
All right, let me try another one. We've got 3 million refugees on the road to Poland. NATO's going to sit by? 3 million.
Well, there's more complications still, and we talked about this. There is very high likelihood of not just a demonstration, but an attack on Transnistria, which is a Russian enclave, caught between Ukraine and Moldova. And both Moldova and Ukraine could get involved, and that would certainly create an escalation in the sense that you would now have potentially Russian strikes right close to Romania, and that would bring in the Romanians. The Poles are champing at the bit. I don't know why, but here they are.
I think you're saying yes.
I'm saying is there is a cognitive dissonance in which a distorted reality overturns the potential intervention of rational analysis. And so that in the heat of emotion, and especially as a kind of culmination, not so much a hysteria, but a culmination of a strategy that is all the more frustrated for being thwarted. Because you have to remember, the Ukrainian victory was in the bag, and therefore it's being thwarted. And it is inconceivable that the great Europe, with the U.S. somewhere in the background, can be defeated in this proxy war. And this actually creates what I would call a break, a kind of disjunction or disruption in the capacity.
I want to understand. Are you ruling out NATO?
I'm not. And I'm trying to explain why such an insane and irrational decision might actually be made, because it's happened before in history. And the reason is really bound up with the deeper subtext of frustration and anger and unwillingness to deal with actual reality as it is unfolding before them. And this is what you see and hear. You can hear it in the texture of Macron's voice, the strain and the unwillingness to accept what has happened. And of course, you know, I could say this was true of France in 1870.
The English papers are using the word Churchill when he speaks now.
Yeah.
This is textbook chauvinism is what's going on here.
Well, the textbook with Churchill is the textbook of Churchill seducing, wasn't hard, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, so that there was the backstop.
You're acknowledging the fact that Macron's words are not empty, that 3 million refugees on the road into Poland, that the collapse of order in Kyiv, all this would lead to NATO having an emergency meeting in Brussels, and we'd suddenly see, a gathering of attack submarines off the Northern Fleet? What is the possibility? We'd move the Navy would move right away.
The problem with a deliberate, highly ritualized progression toward deployment by NATO, you know, involving meetings and gatherings and decisions, it wouldn't be like that. In order for this to happen, there has to be some kind of quick series of events that short circuits.
Well, I just gave you 3 million refugees. What was that? What's that going to look like on the media?
Part of it, but I think some action like in Moldova, Transnistria, or collapse on the front plus refugees, all of that could happen in a way where decisions are made on the fly, and there you know under those circumstances you get poor choices being made. I don't think NATO would deliberately do this, but there could be a kind of a decorporealization here, if I could use that word, in which an entity like France would act on its own outside of NATO. And of course, France has done that, did that with de Gaulle.
Let's go to Moscow. Putin is saying again and again, if you do this, then that. He doesn't have that kind of reach right now. He's hard pressed. He doesn't have. That's why he keeps talking about nukes. He doesn't have. He can't match a deployment on the Baltics. He can't match Poland's air force. He can't do it right now.
That's not true. I mean, he has a whole reserve army of 500,000 that is set aside for just such a contingency, and I don't know of how any NATO military could actually do anything within a period of even months.
I don't mean he has to do something. They just have to deploy. They don't have to move. They don't have to invade. They just have to have the possibility. That's how the Second War started. They moved.
Well, that's right. And, you know, Putin has created the Northern Command, which had been disbanded as a result of Finland.
And they're watching our attack boats. They're certainly watching the F-35s that are in Poland. Germanicus, it's so hard to think irrationally. I can't do it.
No, but this is what is so important now as we rationally try and anticipate. We have to find a way to rationally anticipate irrational behavior.
Do you believe this escalation can be stopped?
Oh, yeah. I think it's unlikely.
Where? How do you stop it?
When there is a collective freak out that the next step will be over the edge. However, I have to say, if we look at the series of events leading to World War I, for example, if there is no freak out, if people don't sort of come to their senses suddenly and say, oh, my God, we're at the edge of a cliff, then they actually walk over it. That's where the irrational.
Aren't the voices of Macron and Putin normalizing that? right now by talking about
it? I don't think Putin is irrational in any sense. He's trying to find language, a very sober language, to say, look, don't take this step. Don't go over the edge. It's Macron who has pushed things now to a point where, one more step would change the entire.
Do you believe Macron can tell Brussels to stand down with 3 million refugees and people frightened? You think they can stand down at that point?
I don't know that Brussels would be the decision maker here. I think it would be more spasmodic. I can't imagine a concerted NATO decision to put forces into Ukraine.
They'd be described as rescue forces. They'd be described as humanitarian assistance for the refugees. They wouldn't go in with tanks, but they come with air.
If it's a NATO decision, it would have to consult with the Russians first, and they would have to both agree that there would be a carve out. And we've talked about this months ago, far western Ukraine. Absent that, if the forces go in, the Russians will strike them. And there we are.
I'm surprised, Germanicus, that you can find a way out of this. I really am. I'm listening to you because escalation.
Yes. Well, escalation is hard to envisage simply because the weakness of the West has been so exposed. So, for example, with France, France can talk all at once, meaning Macron, can talk all he wants about the ability of France to put a corps d'armée in Ukraine. But after the destruction of so much French equipment, like the Caesar artillery,
I'm not going to entertain that the Russians can stand up to a full press from the north, from the Arctic Sea to the Black Sea. I think that they'd have to move first. They can't wait.
Right, and they might.
Once the decision is made, the DEFCON changes, something, you can't wait.
I don't think they will. But having said that, Russia does have space. Because any kind of NATO decision, which I find unlikely, there would be a gap, such a large space between making the decision.
We both know that these are not something you can see. Nobody saw Pearl Harbor. Right. Nobody saw it. Nobody sees anything that happens. That's what you mean by the freak out. That's what you're talking about, the disruption.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, you can't see it because that's why it's a black swan. Right. You can't see it.
Well, I mean, it's a real possibility. This is why it's so scary right now. It isn't so much that it's a real possibility alone. It's the fact that the people who are responsible for making the possibility reality can't see how close they are to the edge of a chasm. And that is, to me, what is scary. Not Putin, but the NATO chiefs. They're so oblivious to how close they are to provoking something unimaginable.
Let's go to Rome. Come on, we can't spend any more time on these NATO characters. All right. Let's go to Rome and speak of what we do know about. This is Germanicus, Michael Vlahos. I am Gaius John Bachelor. We're Roman citizens. It's 91 A.D., the springtime. We're surrounded by retired centurions and their families. We're in Londinium, very far from Rome. Domitian is not adequate, but that's not our concern. He will move on, and there will be good emperors for a century. And then we're discussing how we got here, we Romans, the first century A.D., why we're so confident, why our institutions will still be in charge 2,000 years from now. When we come back, this is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.